Welcome to the Molecular Ecologist Podcast, a conversation about ecology, evolution, and everything in between. Each episode, contributors to the Molecular Ecologist blog get together to discuss the science we've been reading and writing about. In this episode, we'll be talking about the use of color in scientific figures, the surprisingly complex issues around biological invasions in Antarctica, the wild diversity of virus biology, and the costs, in every sense of that word, of applying to tenure-track faculty jobs. I'm Jeremy Yoder, Assistant Professor of Biology at Cal State Northridge in Los Angeles, and I'm the editor of The Molecular Ecologist, and joining me we have...
My name is Patricia Hrzanova-Pechnerova, and I'm a postdoc at the University of Copenhagen.
My name is Stacey Krueger-Hadfield, and I'm an evolutionary ecologist, and I'm an assistant professor at the University of Alabama at Birmingham.
My name is Melissa Walker, and I am a PhD student in Dr. Jeffrey Morris's Evolutionary Microbiology Lab at the University of Alabama at Birmingham.
And my name is Katie Grogan. I'm a postdoc at Penn State and an anthropological geneticist and evolutionary biologist.
Awesome. Welcome, everybody. Let's dive right in. First up, Patricia is going to tell us about her really big compilation of hints and design principles for working with color in figure design, especially in R.
Yeah, that's true. I will talk a little bit about my motivation and the compilation of tools, as you said. I mean, it kind of started as usual from my own work, and I was trying to select new color scheme for my current project. And the thing is that I have now very many populations, like 27 populations, and I somehow wanted to have a color scheme where I could still somehow meaningfully showcase all the populations in some of the plots. Mm-hmm. So I started looking into the tools, how to make the colors, pick the right colors, I would say. And I found many tools which I thought were very useful. And, you know, this is also a way for me to make a list and for future, mm-hmm. make a reference. And I think it can be useful for others as well. And I also hope that, that might to make people think a little bit more about the colors and the figures in general, because as I wrote in my post as well, I feel like many times the aesthetics of science is not something that people pay much attention into. I mean, we pay a lot of attention to having the numbers right, but then every time it's time to make the final plots and get it to publication, it's a little bit more in a hurry. Nobody spends as much time making the paper as appealing, as clear in the visual aspect, I would say. I'm kind of hoping that, that people might spend a little bit more time also on trying to communicate their research and their results through science a bit, or through the scientific publications a bit more visually. I mean, this also goes for posters and other ways of communicating and delivering results. But basically, what my post is about is a little bit trying to argue why it's important to consider colors. Mm-hmm. Our main message with the figures is to draw the attention to the most important result, but also capture all the whole scale of results that we have, and colors can somehow help with this. Can streamline the flow of information and point our attention to where we want to have it. And I highlighted some papers which also argue why it's important to have colors and have nice figures. And then I list quite a few tools, which I think are very, very interesting. You can look at, just pick colors, you can pick color combinations, you can check for colorblind friendly palettes, which I think is very important because, through my career, I've met a lot of scientists who were currently blind, and I think it's important to be considerate in this way. It doesn't cost you much time to just check if the colors look okay, also in colorblind variant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then there are a bunch of tools which I thought were very interesting. Just plotting your model organism in the background of the plot, or picking a colors based on your favorite painting and so on. So there's a lot mm-hmm. of ways how we can express a little bit of our artsy side.
Yeah, I always enjoy figure design, and usually feel like I could have spent another couple of rounds on it when I see things in a final paper. How do you think about the challenge? And I guess this is a little bit less of an issue than it used to be, but when we were originally preparing journal articles primarily for print, one of the concerns was that color was usually an extra charge associated with it, or there were restrictions because it's expensive to use color ink instead of black and white. And so a way that people have navigated that it has been to try to design color figures that will work well in black and white. How do you think about picking colors to sort of simplify in that way out of your control?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think one way, maybe not in terms of color, but one thing that I often do, and I used to do also in for the purpose that you just mentioned, when we had to consider that colors in print won't be color, basically, is using symbols and shapes, for example, to differentiate between the different, for example, populations instead of mm-hmm. color. And it's also sometimes a nice complement when you have color shades which might be too similar for somebody. So it's like an additional layer. But in terms of color, I haven't really used any other solution.
Yeah, I think point shape is something I've used in a couple of contexts. The thing that does come across if you go from color to black and white or grayscale is contrast. So if you can get a color palette that has distinct shades as well as distinct colors, but that starts to get challenging.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Mm-hmm.
Other folks on the panel, did any of you recognize any of these tools, or have you had challenges figuring out?
Yeah, I should actually say that I had input. Input both from Stacy and Katie on this, so they definitely did recognize all of them. So I actually want to thank them because I learned about some really cool tools from them.
I think I had a similar problem when we were doing an invasion history of a seaweed, where I think we had 90 populations, but then when we were running a Bayesian clustering analysis, we ended up with the optimal number of clusters being 23. And trying to find a color palette, and we ended up putting a different number of clusters in the paper, but then in the supplement, finding colors that you could differentiate and still see a pattern that were colorblind friendly. I used the I Want Hue website and just was cycling through. I think I spent 3 days just trying to figure out colors, because how it's really hard for the human eye to distinguish that many colors and make sense of all of that. And mm-hmm. I think the problem now is much easier to handle just thinking when I was making figures for my dissertation, versus making figures right now for a paper. With R, you just have so much more freedom to make really compelling figures if you do take the time for the aesthetic
mm-hmm.
reasons that you were just talking about, that I think we need to spend more time on aesthetics, because it's as important as the text that we're writing with the paper.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, oftentimes that's the first thing that you go through, right? When you just scroll through the paper, maybe you read the abstract, and then you want to look at the figures, and they should be clear, but not just scientifically or in terms of labels and everything, but also, I don't know, somehow they should, I don't know, to me, the aesthetics is important, and nice looking figures are important. And you can especially see it if you find a paper which does have a nice figure, And then you're like, wow, why are not all papers like this?
Well, and I find, I tend to think about it more broadly than just the figures themselves in a paper, because in a paper you can spend, even if you don't do the best job possible, the reader can spend a lot of time reading and trying to interpret the figures. And so for me, the aesthetics of a plot or a figure are critical, not because of the paper, but because I'm planning to use this figure in a talk. Mm-hmm. Or on Twitter or somewhere, and in a talk in particular, people aren't going to have 10 minutes to puzzle out the 32 different plot shapes that, you know, and or the six different shades of the same color that you used because you just didn't feel like changing them. I don't know. And so for me, the aesthetics is something that I've been thinking about for a long time, and I really enjoyed this post. I thought I had a really great compilation of websites in a like bookmarked, and I actually found someone that I hadn't seen before and I was really excited. But for me, it's critical for so many different reasons, particularly for science communication, for when I'm giving a talk either to the general public or at a conference, that those figures really be as crisp and as easily understandable as possible. And the aesthetics is the best way to do that, and colors make such a big difference. And like Stacy said, you know, the tools we have available right now are incredible. And I love the idea this post helps share those resources without you having to go find them yourself. And some of these really are just the best that I've seen so far.
As anybody else, I have taken to generating entirely separate sets of figures for talks about projects relative to what goes in a paper.
Now, I've done that too for color schemes, because mm-hmm. I have a general color scheme when I'm talking about a native population versus a non-native population, and that's not necessarily a color scheme I'd use in a paper. I've made completely different figures, and then I was not so good in the beginning in keeping my R code well annotated, so then I had to go back and reinvent the wheel a few times until I figured out how to like carefully distinguish what's a talk figure and then what's a paper figure.
Mm-hmm. I do the same too, but I find that if I started with a really aesthetically pleasing figure, it's a lot easier to change it for a talk or for a paper if it started out with good colors and good graphics and things like that. You know, it takes way less time than mm-hmm. trying to make a talk figure than a paper figure if I have to change it.
Yeah, I think that makes sense in terms of an order of operations.
It all depends on like where you publish. And there are still print journals that printing in color is still something that you need to think about. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things that I've published, I want to pay for color. It doesn't seem like it's worth it really.
Yeah, although even in those cases, you often can get submit color figures, and they'll just put the little notice that the color version is online.
Yeah, they're online only.
Although then again, you have to think about what will work in a black and white format as well as the color. Cool. Well, yeah, that is it's a great resource, and I definitely recommend it for folks. Let's move along to Stacy. You were going to talk about Antarctic invasions.
Yeah, so over the last, I don't know, 2 or 3 months, there's been a few papers that have come out about invasions sort of being a harbinger of what's to come in Antarctica. And for those readers who aren't that familiar with that region of the world, it's completely cut off by the Antarctic Circumpolar Current and the Antarctic Polar Front. And so the communities of organisms that have been living along the coast of Antarctica and the islands that surround the continent have been pretty much removed and are cut off from the rest of the world. And so there's a very unique flora and fauna. And there's concerns over increasing tourism. In one of the papers that I ended up reading, I found one paper on an invasion of mussels, and then that sort of sparked other news articles that led me to these other papers that have been coming out more recently. And in the 2017-2018 season, there were 42,000 tourists that made landfall at different areas in Antarctica, which is a huge amount when you also factor in how much it costs to go on a cruise to Antarctica.
It's crazy.
There are many very rich people.
Yeah, like a lot of people. And so if you think about just how many people are trudging around, I assume that there are bio monitoring controls in place for shoes and things like that. But there's been this flurry of papers that have been published in, you know, more high impact, flashy journals that have sort of sensationalized some of the invasion. And then there's been this interesting playback on Twitter and in other social media platforms with other researchers saying, well, this is something we've known about for actually quite some time. And then there's discrepancies between whether it's a terrestrial invasion or a marine invasion. And so there were these different parts that I talked about in a post that was supposed to be about one paper, and then it just ballooned into more of a review. And what's interesting is that there's these mussels that have shown up in one of the South Shetland Islands, and they only found it when they were there collecting sponges. And then they took the sponges back to the lab and were looking under the microscope, and then they found these teeny tiny little mussels. And they think what is happening is that it's adults who have spawned, which is kind of concerning because there has long been thought that temperature is a barrier for organisms that are in Australia or New Zealand or South America from getting to the peninsula and then getting to the continent.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can't complete their life cycles. And it looks like, at least for the mussels, that they might be able to. And there was one other really interesting paper about rafting organisms on algae. So this is common in other places in the world. And we knew about Gervalia and Arctica, big brown seaweed, passing and showing up along the peninsula and some of those islands for over 100 years. But I believe Macrocystis pyrifera, which is the giant kelp off the coast of California and Chile, that's a first record for that showing up intact on a beach. But those aren't just the seaweed themselves that might be reproductive and able to release propagules that could start a population, but they're also carrying a lot of hitchhikers. And there was this one really interesting paper that I found by happenstance that had done sort of horizon scanning, and they ended up with a list of 13 or so species, I think. But they eliminated things that they thought would arrive through natural dispersal, parasites, which parasites just like never get any love, and then any microorganisms or fungi. And so I just thought it was interesting some of the decisions that have been made to do these horizon scanning approaches about invasions in Antarctica. And what was curious is that Membranophora, a bryozoan, that's an incredibly noxious invader other places in the world, was not on their list, and that showed up on one of the algae that had drifted across. And Deception Island has an active volcano where it's warmer. And so it's possible that there's these islands that might act as bridgeheads. But one thing that one of the authors mentioned that I think is interesting for all of us sitting at home is that we can use OBIS, we can use GBIF, and there's all this distribution data. So what about species that might have distributions that could facilitate them passively getting to Antarctica or getting to Antarctica on a boat hull? Because one of the more applied policy papers was talking about how it doesn't look like there's really any rules in place for how to clean ship hulls that are docking in these places in Antarctica. Jeez. Just like boggles your mind, right? And so it was not at all what I intended to write initially, but then I found all these other papers, and I think there is something that we can do sitting at home, especially for people who work in Antarctica and who might have had their field seasons cut short, field seasons canceled, starting to generate these distribution records. Because one thing that one of the papers that I can't remember off the top of my head noted is that there's all these distinct biogeographic regions. And so it's not even species coming from South America to the peninsula, but species moving from a different part of Antarctica that we need to have better cataloging of all the taxa in this area. And if you think that we miss invaders sitting in Southern California or down at Dauphin Island in Alabama, or at the Marine Lab in Plymouth in the United Kingdom. Like, people have missed invaders and they're looking for them. Mm-hmm. But you're sitting there year round. People aren't year round in Antarctica. So I think it just highlights some of the challenges of also working in a place that's so remote.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And the differentiation between things that might just, they already have dispersal, natural dispersal capabilities that could get them to Antarctica, but the climates are, as climates are changing, that land is becoming newly accessible. The establishment becomes possible. So the differentiation between that sort of not directly human assisted invasion and then stuff that's coming along on boat hulls or ballast and would not otherwise be transported. It's interesting.
Well, I think that this paper came out, I think, this month, and the last author is Cascade Sorty from Irvine. And they were talking about the importance of terminology for invasive species, for climate shifting species, that mm-hmm. terminology isn't just semantics. It's really important because there's anthropogenically assisted dispersal, but if changes or climate change that is generated by anthropogenic means is changing the circumpolar current or changing the polar front and making those previous barriers that were pretty impenetrable porous, that is one sort of anthropogenic means, but then being on a ship or being on a boat of a tourist or other methods of dispersal, like, those do need to be delineated because they're not the same processes, they're not the same speed. Like, it's going to take a lot longer mm-hmm. to get from South America to the peninsula rafting than it is on a ship that's going to cross in 4 or 5 days.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what's the calculus for, I don't know, some degree of climate change is baked in, and we're not mitigating as fast as we should. So to some degree, like, the communities that are suitable for a lot of these Antarctic environments may change substantially. And on the one hand, we want to conserve the unique biodiversity of Antarctica, but on the other hand, the habitats are changing.
Well, this is a conversation that I actually had on the Zoom meeting 2 meetings before that. I had this one was helping a colleague out for her phycology, online phycology course. And I was talking to Frederic VR and Roscoff, and she's published a paper on the Sargassum muticum invasion, which is this really noxious brown seaweed invader. And there are older people in France where 70, 80 years old, who the Sargassum has completely replaced the native Cystocyra, which mm-hmm. looks similar and filled a similar niche. And they don't really see the difference. So why is there all this discussion about this invasive species that's been here for 60, 70 years? It's just part of the ecosystem now, and it's part of their relationship with that ecosystem. And so then I think one thing that is sort of lacking in invasion biology is more integration with historians and sociologists and understanding people's relationships with the environments that have been invaded, whether they're underwater or on land, and what the history of that is, because there's even questions about what's native, because we've been moving things around for much longer than what I think you appreciate when you take a course like this or you read a paper. You think, oh, these invasions are after the advent of UPS and FedEx. Well, not really. And I think that raises lots of philosophical questions, and it would just be nice if we had more time and funding to do that sort of work that takes time. Mm-hmm. I'm turning out a bunch of papers, but that's like the whole other discussion.
For me, it raises a different point in terms of thinking, because I work with endangered species. And thinking about, if I had a critically endangered species that then becomes invasive somewhere and maybe isn't super harmful, I'm not thinking about ones that are really harmful to the ecology of the area, but thinking about, how do you classify that organism, and how do you think about, with climate change, if their habitat is vanishing, like they is that an invasion? They're shifting, right? We've been talking about shifting ranges a lot in climate change endangered species work, and how do you find the right terminology to balance invasive species discussions with endangered species range shifting discussions? And so now that brings up an entire new area of both like conflict, but potential cooperation between sort of fields that are maybe don't talk to each other as much as they should.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, in some ways, I'm more used to thinking about the Arctic, mm-hmm. and then there everything is much more fluid, right? You have the ice, which throughout the ages has had different extent. The land masses have been connected and disconnected, and what was mainland became island, and so on. So in some ways, it's a completely different, it's very philosophical. It's a completely different way of looking at it, right? In some ways, these things are completely natural. There are stories in the ancient DNA world where we think that there was probably some crossing on a raft and things like that. And this happened thousands of years ago without any contribution from humans. So I guess it's a bit difficult for us to disentangle what is caused by humans, what is not caused by humans, what is natural, what is not natural, what is okay, what we should try to prevent. I think it's a very interesting, line of thought that we are following here.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really important for people who work on invasions in particular to be very careful in their choice of terminology. And the word that seems to meet the least resistance is just something that is non-native. But invasive has negative connotations, and you have to prove to a certain extent that it's invasive. Non-Indigenous has connotations that it's really challenging. And I think anyone working in invasion biology, I think this new paper from Cascade Sorty and her colleagues might be a really nice way to start to differentiate and distinguish terms that should be used for this and terms that should be used for that, and have it become more part of our language about discussing it might help improve some of the ambiguities with using terms loosely or as synonyms.
Yeah, nothing that we're going to resolve in the maybe even in any of our academic lifetimes here, but that is, but these are topics we're all going to be thinking about going forward for sure. Cool. Thank you. Well, thank you, Stacy. Let's go to Melissa and her post about the viruses that attack amoebas.
Yes. So the work that I do as a PhD student revolves around the roles and functions of phages in different types of biofilm environments. And I really just find everything to do with viruses and phages just fascinating. And one of the things I didn't know a lot about were amoebal viruses. And for Stacy's SciComm class, it took me a few weeks to try and find an actual article that I wanted to write about that kind of matched the requirements. But when I did, then I was really excited just because it talks about so many new and exciting things. Amoeba viruses made a splash or came on the scene, I guess you would say, maybe about 2003. And they are different from a lot of other viruses in that their genomes are huge and they're very big. And it's kind of exciting in the virus world to look at them because it helps us try and figure out, I think, a little bit more about their evolution. We have, of course, our tree of life, right? But viruses and phages, they don't really fit into that. We don't have any connection between the phylogenies that we see within viral families and really the tree of life as we have it arranged right now. And it's a struggle and kind of like one of these mind-boggling questions that scientists work with to try and figure out exactly how the one associates with the other. And then in addition to that, it's just looking at the absolute novelty of a lot of these viruses that we're finding in the Mimi virus family. And so for my blog, I wrote about this war between giant amoebas and their viruses. And it really resembles something akin to the Trojan War, where the Trojans were attacked, or Troy, the city of Troy, was attacked by the Achaeans. And of course, that goes back in mythology to the fact that one of the princes of Troy ran off with King Menelaus's wife, Helen, and so they attacked them to try and get his wife back, and it's all that good stuff. But the thing about it that I found so fascinating is that within the Mimi virus family, that these viruses actually act as Trojan horses. So their size, just the fact that their size ranges between like 1.2 to 2.5 microns, kind of disguises them as bacteria. And then amoebas phagocytize them, thinking that they're a bacteria. And that phagocytosis actually triggers the viral genes to start or become active within the amoeba itself. And I focused on one particular virus called Toupan virus, which has a slew of characteristics that we've never found in any other virus to date. And that's what makes it really kind of the Achilles of viruses. You know, Achilles was this amazing warrior, and he was, you know, part god and had a whole bunch of skill sets that you didn't really see in like normal men. And Toupan virus is just like that. So for starters, its genome is the largest, or one of the largest, that you can find in the Mimi virus family. It's about 1.5 megabase pairs in size and includes about 1,250 genes. And then, because viruses aren't technically considered alive, but that really depends on who you talk to. I could get in trouble with some people, I guess, for saying that. But we don't typically consider them to be alive. And one of the biggest cutoffs between the virus sphere itself and like the world of cell biology is really their ability to reproduce or not reproduce without actually having a cell in which to infect, right? So Toupan virus's genome includes one of the most complete sets of translational apparatuses that we found in a genome, a viral genome, thus far. So that has been really exciting for them to see that it is capable of making a lot of its own like tRNA synthases and genes for, it has genes for like tRNA and mRNA maturation, and a lot of amino acyl transfer synthetases, which help to, of course, you know, work with the ribosomes. So that was really exciting. And then in addition to that, it's capable of doing a whole bunch of other things, including infecting a wide range of different hosts, which isn't commonplace really among viruses. It can also trigger ribosomal shutdown in the host cell that it's infecting. And then in addition to that, it also zombifies cells. So once it infects, it causes what's called bunch aggregation. So the bunch aggregation results from this change in conformation in the amoeba cells into like this circularized form. And those circularized forms aggregate together. And that occurs both in the infected and uninfected cells. So then essentially, the Toupan virus has zombified the amoebal cell and forced it to be a vector for its own transmission through this aggregation. So it's just fascinating. And some of the other viruses that you can read about in the article were just as cool. Not quite as cool, but almost.
Yeah, that is some really cool microbial natural history. So the thinking is that a lot of these really unique features of the Toupan virus are basically the reason that they have these great big genomes. They've got all of these additional functions that they're coding for.
Can I actually ask a stupid question? So what was the average number of genes in a normal virus? Do you know?
Well, actually, that's a really great question. And I don't know if I could tell you what the average number is, but viruses range in the number of genes that they have in their genomes. So circoviruses are only about 17 nanometers wide, and their genomes usually only include like two functional genes. But then you can find that there are a number of other viruses that infect things like bacteria, and they have slightly larger genomes, but it's kind of piecemeal what it is that they have. And their genes can comprise anywhere from maybe like 50 to 100 or even more genes. But it's just that the mimiviruses themselves include like 1,250 genes in a virus is just tremendous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kind of mind-blowing.
I'm actually mind blown in the other direction. I'm trying to wrap my head around the idea of something that's functional with only two genes.
Yeah,
someone who works with full organisms, like it is mind blowing to think about a virus having over 1,000 functional genes. Mm. That seems crazy. But on the other end, two? How do you do anything with only two?
But you know, they are not supposed to be living things, so two is much more reasonable for that category than 1,200.
Neither of them seems reasonable to me, which is why biology is awesome.
Exactly. And viruses are just fascinating because you find like just the entire span, two genes to 1,250 genes, but yet still, whatever their host might be, they're able to infect at least effectively enough to reproduce and perpetuate their, you know, I guess, species.
Yeah, you persuaded me. They are fascinating.
Well, cool. The cool thing is that there's some new information coming out that viruses can actually like quorum sense. So, you know, viruses have two different types of lifestyles, and one lifestyle is the lytic cycle where it infects and actually kills its host. But then there's a temperate lifestyle where it can infect, but then it inserts its genome into the actual genome of the host cell, and it stays there until it's triggered to become lytic. And so they're talking about how, you know, the viruses are actually capable of detecting certain environmental conditions and then being able, if they're temperate, they can be lytic or temperate, and they can kind of choose which way it is that they go. So a little bit more on the side of like, maybe they're living things, who knows?
But I guess those are not the ones with two genes, right? That would be quite...
No.
All of this brings me back to our current situation that just says that viruses obviously rule the world.
Yeah, right now, yes.
Well, I think it's fascinating. The more that we learn about the microbial world, the more we've discovered about some of these fine interactions that we didn't know existed. You know, Jan van Etten back in the 70s discovered the first phytoplankton virus, really. And then from there, with the introduction of that type of, I guess, ecology, looking at that, we've really just discovered what a role viruses play in so many different types of biofilm environments, or even just microbial environments. And so it's really exciting to see where the discipline of viral ecology is going to go moving forward.
Yeah, there is more diversity on heaven and on earth than dreamt of in our father's philosophy or whatever.
Yes, take care.
Katie, you've been running a whole series of posts about your experience on the faculty market, mm-hmm. which has concluded successfully, fortunately.
the search concluded successfully. Mm-hmm. I've spent the last 2 years searching for a faculty job. The first year was kind of a dipping your toe into the market sort of year for me, where I just wanted to get my application packet together and practice. And this year I really applied much more widely. And it did succeed, it did successfully conclude. I'm gonna be starting a faculty job in the fall, but one of the things, I tend to be a collector. I'm a little bit of a advice hoarder. Mm-hmm. And so I collected so much advice on applying for faculty jobs and interviewing and how to write your application and how to start as a faculty. And the one thing that when I was done, I felt like there were a few things that I had not gotten a good sense from the advice I had received from the online community about what the cost of going through the job application process was going to be, particularly in the realm of time and emotional burden. So the three posts were about the workload, so the number of hours it took to apply for, to write my application package, apply for, interview for, and negotiate for a faculty job. The second post was about the financial cost, which is actually fairly minimal overall, but in the middle of the process, you can run up to about $1,000 of deficit, basically, while you're waiting for reimbursements. And people had talked about the cost of applying to graduate schools and of attending conferences or being a graduate student, but no one had mentioned to me, I guess, that I needed $1,000 reserve for waiting for reimbursements to be able to pay my bills. And then everyone talks about the stress of applying for jobs, but there were so many other emotions that stress didn't fulfill, that word didn't encompass the just Herculean emotional burden of applying for faculty jobs. And so I wanted to provide this, I don't know, some new commentary, or at least give somebody a heads up at how much time it was going to take. And I time track, so I track how many hours things take me through my work. As part of being a scientist, I like to study myself. And it's somewhat dependent on how many, it's obviously dependent on how many applications you submit. But I submitted almost 40 applications, and my total time was somewhere around 550 hours. And that doesn't actually include the number of hours I was on an interview. That only includes the number of hours I spent prepping for interviews. Mm-hmm. And 550 hours turns out to be something like 6 months of 40-hour weeks. And not that postdocs necessarily work 40-hour weeks, but it's that really concretely put it into terms. When people said to me, "Oh, you won't get anything done." Mm-hmm. I had not interpreted that as from August to May, you will literally only have 2 months of working time. Like that just, you won't get anything done. It didn't encompass that amount of time. And then the financial cost was important to me to clarify for people, because financial burdens is something we talk a lot about in terms of equity and inclusion in the STEM workforce. If you don't have the ability to hold $1,000 in credit card debt for a couple of months waiting for reimbursements, that can really be a problem. And so I wanted people to be aware, right? Like if you're aware of it in the spring, you can maybe save a little or ask, you know, or try to negotiate that the universities will pay for things up front instead of you waiting for reimbursements, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the emotional cost post, I really wanted to talk in particular about the guilt and the jealousy and the depression. I mean, people talk about the stress and the depression and the imposter syndrome, and I wanted to talk about the other ones. I was really surprised, you know, I am so lucky I got an offer, but I was really surprised. The day I got an offer, the truth is that I cried for over an hour. And I talked to a friend and she said, "I threw up. Like I felt horrible." And it was supposed to be the best hour of my life. And it has been ever since that hour. But that first hour was really shocking in how awful I felt. And the more I talked to people, many people agreed with that sentiment. And so I wanted to make people who have felt that way feel less alone, because it can feel really weird to feel like you ought to be really, really happy. And you are. By like 2 or 3 hours, you feel great. But that first 45 minutes is really wrecking. And it's so much more wrecking because it's not supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to, I don't know, give people a heads up that I felt like I needed, that I would have really wanted last year when I started this process, I guess.
The angle you took on the emotional cost was particularly, I think, something I haven't seen discussed in a lot of depth. And it's such a strange process because often you have a pretty good idea who the other candidates for the positions you interview for are, because you know them. They may even be collaborators in other labs or members of the same lab. I remember going on an interview where the university actually double booked me and another postdoc from the same university who I knew and like went to breakfast with and went hiking with in the hotel for like there was a one day or like half a day overlap where we were both there. And I saw him in the lobby. We didn't actually get close enough that it was awkward that neither of us acknowledged each other. I wished him luck. But it was also very, very strange to be like, oh yeah, okay. That's, they're looking for someone who does this kind of stuff.
The whole process was so odd. Like it was so, I felt both on the one hand really prepared for some parts of it because mm-hmm. I'd gotten a lot of advice. There's a lot of discussion about parts of it online, how to give a job talk, how to handle hard questions, how to do the one-on-one interviews, how to handle the meals, et cetera. But I felt like there were some holes. And my sort of goal in writing these was to maybe try to provide some perspective. I'm also part of the Future PI Slack group, which is a group of postdocs and grad students who want to become primary investigators. And so, and I solicited some thoughts and suggestions from them and shared the post afterwards with them and got a lot of really positive feedback, basically saying either one, this was my experience as well. And I don't necessarily want to put my name to it, but I agree with your feelings about the post. Or people who had not yet been on the job market who said, thank you for writing this. You know, I now at least I feel a little bit more prepared. Jeremy was in a much odder position. Because I am so interdisciplinary in terms of anthropology and genetics and evolutionary biology that I actually applied very widely. I applied mm-hmm. for evolutionary biology positions and anthropology positions and genetics positions and climate change positions. And so I actually didn't know a single person who I interviewed against. I knew one person out of six interviews. I knew one person I was competing against. And so I had very few of those sort of awkward dancing around interactions, but I did have a lot of, what I actually found to be the hardest was managing the expectations of my primary advisor. And managing the expectations of collaborators and co-authors and what I was able to get done in the time while I was on the job market. So that was actually what a lot of people commented on, was that they intended to share the post with their advisor to explain why the last three papers haven't been written in the last 6 months. It's a very, very odd process. And some of it is really well covered and some of it, I mean, I wouldn't have written some of those posts if I hadn't gotten a job. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have been in the right mindset mm-hmm. To publish them. And we have a really, I think is going to be awesome upcoming post about sort of what to do if you were a postdoc who didn't
maybe yes.
work successful this year.
That's going to be a good contribution to this conversation
too. Yeah, and I'm really excited about it. It's going to be a great sort of bookend to this post in terms of like, how do you pick yourself up? And I'm super excited about the advice that's given in that post. Mm-hmm. I told you all this on Slack. I'm going to say it on the podcast. Publishing that last emotional cost post was really hard. It took me over an hour to actually hit the publish button once it was written, because admitting those feelings was hard. But I
Sorry, I just want to say that I really liked it, and I think it's brave because that's also something that you quite often don't come across, not just because people don't want to talk about it, but it's more like you don't want to share the hard feelings. I mean, it's harder to share the feelings like guilt and jealousy.
Who wants to tell your friends I was really jealous of you?
That's very, very human, and I think it's nice to say it out loud because it's not like people don't feel it, right?
Well, and I found in my career that the hardest part is feeling alone in your feelings, is feeling like you're the only one who feels that way. And so part of what I wanted to do with this was, yeah, it really was hard to admit, but it was easier once I talked to 10 friends and they all felt the same way. They had all felt those same feelings. And I just wanted the next person not to feel so alone and not to feel so odd or horrible that they were feeling those feelings.
I think that's really important at any career stage, though. Like, I applied to, I don't remember how many, I was not as good at tracking as you or Jeremy for the number of jobs that I applied to, but there was one job I did apply to that I got a letter about 9 months later. Somehow I think I must have gotten on to their HR letter scheme somehow about the person they hired and how great that person was. And that was a really great thing to get in the mail.
Oh.
What's this letter from this place I applied to? Did they change their minds? And it was like, no, we hired this new person. They're so fantastic. And I mean, I think we all have to think we're fantastic in a certain degree because this is a self-motivated job. You have to believe in yourself and you have to think that you're great at what you do without being a jerk about it. But I just sat there. I went home to work early and I remember getting the mail, opening it, and then I just watched TV. This is like before I had Netflix. So I just put on some DVD, I think maybe even Lord of the Rings or something, and just watched something mindless because I felt like I was crap. And I know that's not true, but I think that this is something that if you're a master's student, an undergrad, a PhD student, a postdoc, a new faculty member, you have to talk to your peers because everybody's experiencing the same roller coaster of emotions all the time and it's totally normal. But I think you paint yourself into a corner that you tell yourself it's not normal to be jealous. I was super jealous of some of my friends who I knew got jobs that maybe I didn't apply to that job, but how did they get a job? What am I doing wrong? And then you just start attacking yourself. And I think it's really important that we have these sorts of groups across the board, particularly right now, just talking to some of the grad students in my department. I think they need to talk to each other a lot more to reinforce that this is normal, productivity is going to be off, and that's okay.
Well, and I think it's just really hard to be vulnerable. And I think in particular, it's hard for everybody to be vulnerable, but it's, for me anyway, I felt that it was particularly hard to be vulnerable in academia because vulnerabilities can be used against you. And also because vulnerabilities means admitting that you're not as awesome as you try to tell yourself, because telling yourself how great you are is part of how you motivate yourself to get stuff done, right? But if you admit you're not as good, then it's hard to get work done. And it's just becomes this sort of spiraling cycle. But admitting vulnerability is also so important to not feeling like you're the only one that is this horrible person or has these feelings or is struggling right now. And I agree with Stacey 100% that right now admitting vulnerability might be a really powerful tool to helping everyone feel both more connected and also a little bit less burdened. Mm-hmm. And in particular, this applying for jobs, you know, applying for jobs is a really, everyone I talked to equated it to the 8 months before your dissertation is due. It's the worst part of, you know, like, that 8 months is usually the worst part of your dissertation. And it turns out that applying for jobs is the worst part of being a postdoc. And they are, having now been through both, they are pretty comparably horrible. Mm-hmm. And the only way that I got through the dissertation part was my friends, was being vulnerable with my friends and with my colleagues. And the only way I got through applying for jobs was being vulnerable with my friends and colleagues. And now I have done it with the entire world. And I hope that the world finds it valuable. Yes.
I think folks definitely are.
I think one thing which is also a bit difficult about it is that, as you say about the vulnerability, I mean, those people that you decide to be vulnerable with who are your friends, and I mean genuine friends, they are also your biggest competitors, right? They are your colleagues, they are people who are going to be applying for the same jobs, and you might love them, you might be best friends with them, but they are still going to be at some point competing with you for the same resources. So it's really difficult to handle all the feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and admitting them can help you maintain those friendships in a stronger, right? It can turn those kinds of things that could be competitions into a much more positive, more cooperative type thing, or at least prevent those relationships from becoming troublesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking about it is definitely the better way than just kind of letting it bubble under the surface.
Thank you again for the series, Katie. It's I think it's gonna be real helpful for folks who are thinking about jumping into this process, and for folks who are sitting in it right now. And we've got the upcoming post by Letitia Wilkins on what happens when you're still in the process, or thinking about exit ramps that aren't necessarily the faculty position. So I think that is a pretty good point to wrap things up. You can find all of the posts we've discussed this episode on the blog at molecularecologist.com, and you can follow updates from the Molecular Ecologist on Twitter at @MOLEcologist, or find us on Facebook. The Molecular Ecologist podcast is produced by Turning on Zoom and Hoping for the Best. We're hosted on anchor.fm, and you can subscribe there or via Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and a bunch of other services. If you've enjoyed this episode, please take the time to rate and review it, and help us build an audience to keep this thing going. Thanks to all of our panelists, and we will see you next time.
Take care.
See everyone next time.
Take care and be safe. Thank you so much for the opportunity to participate in the podcast.
Yeah, everybody stay safe and have a good rest of your month.
Until next time, hoping all your code is bug-free, all your PCR targets amplify, and all of your reviewers are friendly and thorough.